when the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain. And you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
I'm Mark Laren Young, and thanks for checking out the Green Chain Podcast. Bob Simpson is BC's opposition critic for forestry, and with the pine beetle plague, a rising dollar, falling mills, and a controversial forest minister, there are no lack of things for him to criticize. I talked to Simpson about the pine beetle plague, why he thinks BC's forestry roundtable is an excuse to dance around the issues, and what he'd do if he was Minister of Forests.
Okay, to start with, how did you end up in Quesnel?
Oh, that's... I came out of the University of Victoria with a teaching certificate, as did my wife, who I met at UVic and married in our final year there. And we were given a choice of the Queen Charlotte's as a possibility or Quesnel as a possibility, where we both could get teaching positions in the mid-80s because there weren't lots of teaching positions around. So we moved up to Quesnel, where my wife is from. That was the attractor.
Okay.
With the intention of being there for a couple of years, and it's now, 25 years later, and we're still there.
Now, were you in the Navy before that?
Yes, I was. That's what brought me out to British Columbia in the first place. I grew up in Scotland. My folks immigrated to Winnipeg, Manitoba. And then I was a sea cadet, and... I had all kinds of difficulties with my dad trying to live his life through me, so I escaped to the Navy instead of going to university, and that's what brought me out to BC.
Okay. What prompted you to get into politics?
Madness.
That's as good a reason as any.
I joke that I wasn't comfortable with it until I got my frontal lobotomy. Now I'm very comfortable with my life in politics. But the last 14 years of my life I spent as a change management consultant, organizational effectiveness consultant. I had dabbled in politics before, when Gordon Campbell was seeking the Liberal leadership and assisted him to win the Liberal leadership, and then was his policy co-chair for his first policy convention in Whistler. And that whole time with him taking over the Liberal Party, the Social Credit taking over the Liberal Party, and the formation of that coalition, and some things with our own riding association there, jaundiced me against the whole political process. I thought it was just absolutely not connected to the reality of the day and walked away from it. I started doing my master's at Royal Roads in 2003-2004. And as someone who'd spent a lot of time now in the corporate world, the business world, thinking about how to make organizations more effective, coaching leaders and CEOs and others, as I was at Royal Roads, you were given a chance to actually reflect on where you were at in your life and were you contributing to the level that you could be contributing. And something was happening, I don't even remember what it was, on the political scene that made me very angry about what was going on. And I was shaving one morning and looking myself in the eye and saying, well, either shut up or do something about it. And that's how I decided it would be worth at least attempting from the inside to see if the political system could actually be changed. And if you can actually make that system more meaningful to the voters who seem to be walking away from it.
Now, you worked with Gordon Campbell. How did you end up as a candidate for the NDP?
I looked at the parties where they were at that time. I didn't make any judgments about, past affiliations. I think one of the problems we have right now is people consider themselves to be genetic voters or ancestral voters. If my folks were Socreds or my folks were Liberals, that's how I'm supposed to vote. So I stepped back from it. I looked at the possibility of running as an independent. People said, no, we're not ready for that. I then looked at the political parties. I looked at what Carol James was doing at the time with the NDP. And I had, because of my experience in large corporations, I had really understood how disconnected those entities are from community. And I'm much more community-oriented, and the party that is more community oriented and more oriented to, you know, citizens and workers and people who really ought to get more benefit from our natural resources. That was the NDP, not the Liberals, because the Liberals are not liberal; they're ultra conservative, and under the Campbell leadership have become, you know, quite right wing, and I just did not feel comfortable with that, and I felt much more comfortable with Carroll and the NDP at that time.
Did that surprise you? I mean, I'm assuming something must have shifted in what Gordon Campbell did that shifted your politics or shifted you away from Liberals, since you were involved with them earlier.
Well, what Gord's like as Premier is what I saw him in the early days as leader of the Liberal Party. Anti-democratic, very dictatorial. When he makes up his mind, he brooks no dispute with that, so he disengages people very quickly. And the sense of playing to the larger interests, especially the corporate interests, was not in his leadership bid, but certainly became evident in the early days of his leadership of the party. And we've seen that writ large in British Columbia. We've seen the favoritism of the corporate sector. We've seen and particularly as a rural MLA and as a rural resident of British Columbia, that sort of abandonment of rural British Columbia in favor of the large metropolitan centers, only, I think, because that's where the major voting bloc is. So the pandering to that voting bloc, and what it became for him was power. So I saw that very clearly, and I saw that, and it was part of what jaundiced me against the whole process and made me leave. So it's not as surprising to me that I couldn't go back there again, because all we've got that is a writ large in his premiership.
Well, it's just traditionally the Socreds were elected through rural votes.
Correct. But the Socreds had a sense of the land. The Socred had a sense of where true wealth comes from, and it comes from our natural resources. And they had a very real sense is that the government had an obligation to flow some of the benefits of those resources back to the people of British Columbia. I don't believe the Socreds would ever have done the wholesale privatization of British Columbia's resources that this government has done, or disconnected benefits of our natural resources from communities like this Liberal government has done.
Now, I get the idea of you becoming minister of, critic for Force,
yes,
and Ranges, based on the fact that you're the NDP MLA in the Cariboo.
Yeah.
Did you have a connection to those issues as a citizen? Did you have a connection to forestry through your work?
When I first moved out to Quesnel, I taught for about seven and a half years, and I actually, with another colleague, developed a forestry curriculum. I found it quite astounding, because it was my wake-up call to forestry when I moved into a forestry town, which Quesnel is, that there was no instruction of forestry in our formal education system, that people didn't understand how much that was the lifeblood of the economic activity of the province. So I developed a grade 11, grade 12 forestry curriculum and tried to bring in the sustainability ethic and the sense of the land base and the questions around are we managing our resources for future generations into that, and actually try to get that accredited as an accredited program in the K-12 system, and not successfully. Then I did consulting work. When I left teaching, I had my own management consulting business, some retail companies, and I started to do some consulting for forestry companies and did some worker adjustment programs, industrial adjustment programs. One of those contracts led me for the last 9 years before I got elected to become part of the corporate management team for Weldwood of Canada, a company that no longer exists. So I did capital projects for them. I did the human resource side of capital projects, worked with our senior management team, helped design training programs, did change management programs within the forestry company that I was a corporate manager for.
Were you working with Weldwood when they vanished?
Yes. West Fraser bought us the year. I had already signaled to the company I was intending to go back to private consulting. I didn't like International Paper, who owned us at the time. I didn't like where we were going or what they were doing on the world scene. I was reading stuff about International Paper as a world player that I didn't like. And so I had signaled I was planning on leaving, and then Wes Fraser ended up buying us that August. So I stuck around and was actually, as a candidate, still on the Wes Fraser payroll, but as a bought-out employee and part of their downsizing that they did.
Well, I mean, what have, you know, you've been living in Quesnel. I've got a friend who works at a mill in Williams Lake, and I can no longer keep track of what his mill is called. I think, I'm sure I'm mixing it up, but I think it's been Lignum Weld Wadam West Fraser from the last few years. Does that sound about right?
Probably, yeah, if it's Lignum, it's probably Lignum Slocan Canfor or something like that, or Tolco, yeah.
I know. It's gone through, I think, at least three owners.
Right.
In the last...
I think the Lignum one went through to Tolco, is what it did.
Oh, Tolco, yeah. Sounds right.
Yeah.
So what have you seen happen there, and why is it happening?
It's a deliberate choice on the part of the Liberal government on forest policy changes that they made in 2003 in collusion with the major companies at the time. The government was convinced that the business model that we needed for success was a very high volume dimension lumber production for the U.S. market, that we had to go big or go home. And in order to go big, what the government needed to do, and this is from the corporate entities, they need to free them from all of the encumbrances of the public policy that drove them to return benefits to communities through things like appurtenancy, the tying of wood to specific mills, the oversight that the minister had on tenure changes, and tenure is how we allow companies to get access to the land base to get logs for their mills. So what the government did is freed up the tenure system so that when I want to flip the tenure, when I want to buy a company, in the past, the minister had to be involved. There was a requirement for public consultation. Often the public would push back and say, we don't like this, it's too concentrated, and so on. There was take back of the tenure and the cutting rights. All of that was gone. The government removed it all. So what they effectively did was they made the public forest tenures like private holdings, tradable commodities. So that allowed all of these companies then to buy each other up with impunity, because there was no constraints or restrictions on them getting more and more control over the land base.
Was there one particular regulation or change in law, something that shifted the appurtenancy?
They just removed it. They actually just physically removed the appurtenancy clause from the forest licenses, in particular the tree farm licenses, so just gone.
Was that debated? Was that, or did it just disappear?
Remember, you had to, yeah, only had an opposition of two, with a whole slew during that 2001-2003, where the government's agenda was being ramrodded through with only two people in opposition and a premier who would not even recognize them as an official opposition in order for them to get the resources of an official opposition. So they were only resourced as two MLAs. And if you go back and look at the Hansard, the public record, you'll see that Jenny and Joy did their best to say, hang on a second, is this the right thing to do? And they got some assistance to do that. But there was also a whole slew of other legislation that was being rammed through at the same time. And I think what happened, too, in British Columbia, I think the environmental community fell asleep at the switch. The union community fell asleep at the switch. And I think part of the problem is that the expectations of a right-wing government are that they're going to do what right-wing governments do. They're going to deregulate, they're going to privatize, they're going to make government smaller and all of those things. And so our expectations are so low, it doesn't force us to take to the streets and protest, because what are you protesting against? The difference with an NDP government or a more progressive government is your expectations are higher. So when they don't meet your expectations, you take to the street and you let them know that you're not happy with them because you think you can change their mind. So during 2002, 2003, 2004, very little protest as these sweeping changes were made, but now they're coming to roost. Huge companies have disappeared. 50 mills closed in this province since 2001. From January 07 as a result of this combination of the market downturn and the forest policy, we're up to about 14,000 workers that have been directly impacted because we only have a few companies left and their whole business model is a U.S. market that doesn't exist.
Well, I know that they're now kind of opening and closing the mills sort of at will.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, keep it, so regular employees are still being told, yeah, you're coming to work this week, but this week we're closing, and then the next week we're opening again, and the next mm-hmm. week we're closing again.
If we were in a more stable labor environment, if our unemployment rate was higher, so our normative kind of unemployment rate of 7 to 9% or, you know, up to about 10%, I think you'd see a lot of these mills down on these indefinite closures. The problem that the few remaining companies have is that they're very worried about losing their workforce to be able to bring their mills back up when the market rebounds. So they're doing temporary closures, temporary shift layoffs in order to try and keep people around and still take some volume out of the marketplace. So I think that's a labor issue just in terms of them being worried about losing that workforce, that they're kind of up and down like that. But in a normal market condition, I think our mills would most likely, most of them would be down.
Well, I think your website listed about 6,000 job losses. I mean, you had a
mm-hmm.
just stunning.
Yeah. Yeah, we're up to about, our count is about 14,000 job losses now since January of 07. So that's not the job losses that were occurring before that.
Okay.
And so what we're saying, like the government's response to that is, they can't manage a dollar that's now on par. They can't be blamed for a market that's collapsed and so on. Our response back to that is, yes, you can, because you collapse the industry to four or five companies whose main business model is high-volume U.S. production. We've lost the independence. We've gutted the manufacturing, secondary manufacturing, the remanufacturing, the value added. They're all gone because we bottled up all of the log supply into these few remaining large corporate entities that have played Pac-Man with each other for the last 7 years. Well, so it's the business model that doesn't work. If we had a free flow of logs in British Columbia, if we had a true log market in British Columbia that wasn't under the control of these Dimension Lumber producers, I think you'd see a whole different level of employment, and we would be able to get through this without as much damage as we're having now.
It's like, I remember my high school social studies teacher explaining that the problem with Canadian economics was we'd cut down the trees and we'd ship the trees to the States, and now we're cutting down the trees in Williams Lake or Quesnel, and those logs are being shipped to where Kelowna, Kamloops. So you're losing the jobs within.
Yeah. So what's happening?
BC's killing BC.
Correct. So what's happening now? And Kamloops is a perfect example of this. In Kamloops, Weyerhaeuser, which is attempting to get out of British Columbia but couldn't, they were trying to sell their mills at the wrong time. They were trying to sell their mills when the market was collapsed and nobody wanted them. What is the gold? Are the forest licenses and the logs, and that's tied to the mountain pine beetle and the fear that when the mountain pine beetle cut comes down, where are you going to get the wood to run these mills? So when Weyerhaeuser permanently closed its sawmill in Kamloops, the community got caught off guard, including the First Nations community, Shuswap First Nation, when in the same announcement of the permanent mill closure was the announcement that the forest licenses were already sold to West Fraser for use in their mills in 100 Mile House in Williams Lake, and that West Fraser had already sold some of those forest licenses to Interfor to use in Adams Lake. So that's what this Liberal government forest policy has allowed, is that no public consultation, no ministerial oversight or approval, nobody gets the opportunity to say, hang on a second, how do we continue to create jobs and community benefit in Kamloops? It's a done deal. It's a business transaction. It was a trading of a privately held asset. So now you've got a situation in which British Columbia, and you're absolutely correct, is susceptible to a concentration in the flow of wood supply, so that conceivably in the interior we could have four or five of these mega mills and that's it. And the wood from around the province just flows to the lucky four or five communities that have one of these big mills.
Now, you're the forestry critic. I know we've already gotten into some of this. What are the biggest things you'd criticize? Like, what are
First of all, absolute lack of leadership on the part of the current forest minister. He just does not understand the importance of the role that he has as the chief steward of the public resource, their public forest, as the person who's supposed to make sense out of what's going on and make sure that there's a return to the public good. He just hasn't done his job. He's allowed this wholesale privatization of lands out of tree farm licenses. He's flipped lands out of tree farm licenses and completely abandoned communities despite their protest. He still won't revisit those decisions. He won't intervene when there are opportunities for the minister to come to communities and say, how do we keep these mills open? What can we do to cut deals with the unions, the communities, the contractors, the company, to see if we can keep these things going? He just doesn't intervene in any of that. He steps back, and he's admitted a number of times that he's a spectator, his hands are tied. So that's number one. It's probably the worst forest minister this province has ever experienced at the worst possible time. When we need real leadership, we're not getting it. Secondly, the government is not understanding that if they do not create a free log market in British Columbia, where an entrepreneur in Enderby, and this is a classic example, can create jobs through cedar production in that area to a market that will pay a high price for that, who can employ 100 people in that mill, and he has to let them all go and shut the mill down because he can't get access to the logs, or somebody in the Queen Charlotte's, or I could name legions of these people who can actually be employing people just now, but they cannot get a log in British Columbia because of the monopoly that these small these large companies have over those logs. So we have said the tenure system has to be changed. It's time. We've talked about this since the 1950s or earlier, that it has to change. But now that we're in this crisis mode, I think the appetite for change is there and the opportunity to do that is there. And let's create a free log market. And then the third major piece would be that we're not engaging in assisting communities and workers and families to get through this crisis. There are going to be job losses. There are going to be permanent mill closures. There's going to be communities impacted. But these are all communities that have paid year after year, decade after decade, to the public coffers, to run this province, to pay for the social programs, to allow us to enjoy the kind of lifestyle that we live. Surely we have an obligation to flow some of that wealth back to them in their time of need to help them through their transition process. And this government has not put one penny to that. They're using a contribution from the federal government, $129 million that they just got, and that's it. They're not putting one provincial dollar towards that program, and it's not enough. And we've been saying that for the last 3 weeks, that the government needs to pony up and make sure that we help these communities through this time.
What do you think of the roundtable?
I think the roundtable is an excuse not to act. I think that the government understands that what they chose to do in 2003 is to back the wrong horse. It's the wrong business model. It's not going to work. If you look at us globally, we are in competition with low-cost producers, and they're low-cost producers because they don't have the employment standards that we have. They don't have the requirements for sustainable forest management and long-term forest management that we have. So they can discount and come into the marketplace much cheaper than we can if you're in that primary product. We needed to go to the market with a different model. They backed the wrong horse. As a consequence of all the changes they made, though, there's not a lot of scope for them to now make the kinds of changes that we need to make without either paying through the nose, because they did a 20% clawback of the tenure system and paid between $25 and $27 a cubic meter to get our public forests back under public control. We can't afford then, under their regime, to go and to buy back all the tenure system. They've also been non-interventionist with respect to these larger companies. So I think when the Premier, facing him standing up in front of one of the biggest forestry conferences in the province still, the truck loggers conference in January of this year, he had to say something. There wasn't much that he had an opportunity to say that was constructive or deliberate, so he announced a roundtable. And I think it's a stalling tactic to get them through the 2009 election.
Well, I can't. I've had several people now who know about the podcast and know about the movie send me different petitions that are now up calling for Rich Coleman's resignation.
Correct, yeah.
Do you know where those stand and
yep.
how those all sparked?
I tabled one that the Dogwood Initiative had on the go, a combination of signatures and electronic petition, almost 2,500 signatures calling for Coleman's resignation. We tabled another one, 1,400 signatures, John Horgan, MLA, from Malahat 1 to Fuca tabled it, and again, it was off our website, sending a clear message to the government that this minister wasn't doing his job. Now, a lot of that is sparked because of the minister's release of lands from tree farm licenses without consultation and without compensation to the Crown. But more and more, we're getting people understanding he's not the right guy for the job. So then the steelworkers, for the first time ever, the former IWA, now it's part of the steelworkers, came forward and asked for a minister's resignation. It's the first time they've ever done it. They didn't do it lightly, but they understand that it's a minister who simply refuses to do his job and show the leadership that we need.
I can't think of any other minister who's taking this kind of heat.
No.
Okay.
No. And in fact, if you go back and look at ministers of forest, often they had to have, pardon the expression, big kahunas in order to protect the public interest against the sort of the shareholder or private interest, because British Columbia's forests are public forests. And that's what we seem to have forgotten. And so, whether it was a Tom Waterland or whoever was in there, they would actually drive change. They would see a different vision that needed to be accomplished. So our tree farm license process, for example, was a deliberate way to force companies to invest in interior communities. And the appurtenancy clause said, okay, look, you'll get the logs, but you have to build a mill, you have to employ people, and you have to return a public good to the community that's surrounded by those logs, because it's a public forest. It's not a privately held asset. So forest ministers for generations always stood up and protected the public interest. You now have a forest minister who has no problem in the legislature publicly saying that he's all for free enterprise, that private lands are private lands, and that he's not going to intervene to protect mills or protect jobs. So he's a private enterpriser, great, but he's the leader and the steward of a public resource. The wrong guy for the job.
Okay. Mentioned the Beatles earlier.
Yeah.
Where are you, where is the NDP on what to do about the Beatles?
Well, again, first off, people blame the NDP for the Beatles, which I find quite interesting.
Yes, right? I've heard that from quite a few people.
If only we had intervened in Tweedsmuir, which I think, again, is the propaganda that's out there around how we could have solved this.
Well, I am hearing if only the NDP had had intervened in the Tweedsmuir from NDP supporters.
This isn't just from the right,
this is from the left.
Exactly. Here. But I think, as you well know, the media can tell a good story, and if you've got a specific message you want to get out through the media, you can distort the thinking of a whole lot of people quite permanently. The reality is, just go look at California, Washington State, where the mountain pine beetle and other pine beetles ran their course. Look at the spruce forests in Alaska, where the beetle ran its course. We have a problem of a number of factors. One, we protect the forest against fire. Two, climate change has taken cold away. And there's only three disturbances in the forest ecosystem: fire, cold, pests, and disease. So the third thing is we laid the table for the mountain pine beetle through successive generations of forest managers, and now it's running its course. There wasn't just one epicenter in Tweedsmuir. There were epicenters all over the place, and they've all come together into this massive epidemic that we have just now. And the reality is there were attempts at intervention in Tweedsmuir. There was some single tree, there were burns, there were all kinds of things. It just didn't work because it was an inevitability given climate change removing cold. We always managed beetles with cold before, not anything else.
Well, I remember, I mean, this is one of the reasons that I got confused during that it was all about Tweedsmuir, because when I was in Williams Lake in 85, covering forests, I remember listening to the people in the Ministry of Forests pray that the cold snap was going to last two more days than it did.
Yeah. All anybody has to do is go on and actually look at the Ministry of Forests time-lapse map of the beetle spread. And you'll see those early epidemics, and you'll see that as you come into the 92, 93, 94, you'll see 5 and 6 spots that this grew from. And the reality is that we always managed epidemics with cold. We didn't get the cold, so it got away from us. It wasn't until 2002.
So you're saying Mike Harcourt is to blame for the weather?
Yeah. That's, no, people are.
Sorry.
But that's right.
It's just that Mike Harcourt got blamed for an awful lot of things. I think that if it's his fault that it didn't get cold enough.
Sure. I blame Harcourt or Clark. If you look at it on a graph, you'll see the spike and the massive upturn beyond normal epidemic was in 2002. So the NDP was gone. The Liberals were in power. And the graph clearly shows that's when everybody understood this was different than any other epidemic that we've ever had. In 2001, in the fall of 2001, Premier Campbell stood in Prince George and said, this is an emergency. This is going to have huge socioeconomic implications for the province of British Columbia, and we're going to address it immediately. He sent a group of his own MLAs out to investigate it. Again, late in the fall of 2001, they said, we need to declare this a state of emergency. This is an epidemic that is different than anything we've ever experienced, and we have to address it as such. Fast track forward to just before the 2005 election, and it's the first time that the provincial government starts to do anything, and it's just because they know that in the central interior they're in serious trouble because they haven't put one penny into the mountain pine beetle from 2001 to 2005. So what can you do? Could the Liberals have stopped the epidemic? No. Couldn't have happened. What could they have done? They lost a number of years, and as far as I'm concerned, they're still losing it. We're now 2008. We don't have a transition strategy for any community in the mountain pine beetle epidemic. There's no transition strategy for Quesnel, for Williams Lake, for Vanderhoof. None of those communities know what the future holds. And we're looking now at maybe 2012, when the mountain pine beetle cut comes down. We can still not tell those communities when the cut level will come down, how deep it will come down, and how long it will be down for. We can't tell them that. And it's no longer mountain pine beetle, because if people think for 2 seconds, no fire, no cold, pest and disease is the third disturbance, every pest and disease in the forest is on the rise. Every age class is being hit, right down to plantations. The forest is a mess, and we don't have data to tell those communities what that mess looks like for their economic activity for the future.
How do you feel about trees?
Do you want me to say I'm a tree hugger? Do you want me to say I love them? I think trees are absolutely essential. I mean, partly, I guess, let me step back and say, how do I feel about ecosystems? Because trees are a part of an ecosystem. We depend on them for so much. And I guess what I've come to grips with over the last 3 or 4 years is that we have outlived the usefulness. I used to write about sustainability in the 80s and early 90s. We've outlived the usefulness of sustainability as a three-legged stool. It's not a balance between economics, social systems, and environmental systems. What we have to fundamentally understand is that if we do not have resilient, robust ecosystems, we have nothing. There are no economic systems, there are no social systems that can sustain ecological collapse. And that's what we're threatened with just now. That's what the mountain pine beetle is suggesting to us, that normative ecosystems are beginning to collapse. you exacerbate that with something like climate change and the scale that's on, where we're on positive feedback loops, and we're going to see more and more and more of this collapse. We're in serious trouble. It's not just trees. It's the grasses. It's the lichen. It's the mushrooms. It's all of the components of a healthy ecosystem, and we're threatening it, and we better figure out a different economic system that we can stop extracting and destroying ecosystems and still have a meaningful way of life. Otherwise, there's not a lot of life for humans.
If you got to take over as forest minister, what would you want to do?
First off, for the current crisis, we would sit down with the federal government and we say, look, we need to put some resources to these communities. They deserve it. We need to get in there and we need to stabilize them. We need to understand what communities will have the resources to actually be forestry communities beyond this crisis, which are not, and which are we going to have to do a major transition strategy to make them viable as some other kind of diverse economic structure. It's going to take some resources, this year, for example, the provincial government gave $200 million in tax breaks to banks. I think that $200 million could have gone to these communities, and it would be more deserving to do that. Secondly, we need to understand what's happening on the land base, and I would immediately undertake an inventory project on a sort of a World War II response scale. I would get every registered forest technician, registered forest professional, forestry student, and we would engage them in a major inventory project to understand what's really happening on the land base. We need eyes and ears on the ground, and we need to map that, and we need to model it so we know what's going on. In conjunction with that, pull together the best minds that can tell us what forest management looks like in a world of climate change. And again, from that information, sit with the federal government, because it's really a joint effort, and say, look, here's a 10-year forest management plan that we need to initiate. Here's where we need to do some active work on the ground. Here's where we need to do some research work, but put together a longer-term plan to try and make sure we're managing our forest for resilient, adaptive forest ecosystems. And then the third major thing I would do is take all of the CEOs of all of the companies that hold tenure, sit them in a room and say, we're changing the system. We're delinking forest tenures from manufacturing. We are not going to manage our forests for 2x4s. We're going to manage them for resilient forest ecosystems, but we're going to guarantee you that there's going to be a log market there that you can come in and bid and you can get your profile. We're going to stop you worrying about forest stewardship and public policy, and we're going to allow you to worry about the marketplace and where it's going. But we're going to change the tenure system so that communities get access to the tenure, First Nations get access to the tenure, and we have a whole bunch of diverse tenure holders who can manage the land base and get logs into a log market and allow biopharmaceuticals to get in there, biochemicals and lubricants to get in there, people who make bioplastics, ethanol producers, all of those people will be able to get access to the resources they need to generate a different kind of forest resource economics. So there's my three right off the bat.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Green Chain Podcast. For more on Bob Simpson and a list of lost forestry jobs, check out his website at bobsimpsonmla.ca. Coming up on future episodes, 80-year-old activist Betty Krosick and Scared Sacred's Velcro Ripper. For the Tyee, I'm Mark Laren-Young.